All right. Feeling good? You've told me you've been feeling good for like
a minute and a half now. I've been feeling so right. I've been feeling fantastic. Been eating healthy, drinking plenty of water, playing plenty of Smash.
I've been eating healthy too.
Good. They both said after eating a donut right before recording.
Half a donut.
That's true. We're very healthy.
Trying to blow up my spot.
New year, new pre-dead boys.
Make it fit.
That's right. Okay. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to...
No! Don't say that! That's
that
me!
New. Not that new.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. I've been ready.
Welcome to the Pre-Dead Boys. It's a podcast about the history and culture of death and decomposition. My name is Dorian. With me, as always, is Max. How you feeling, Max? How you doing?
Pretty good. Did you have a bit to open this with?
Ooh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, real quick. I'll totally edit this out, but we're recording today on December 30th, and this episode's not going to come out until 2019. And so we kind of need to already act like it's 2019.
Yeah, that's
like,
my bit.
Yeah. Like, we already need to... I'm totally going to edit this out. But we kind of need to act like it's 2019 and that Akira and Blade Runner already happened and that there's flying cars and cool motorcycles and clown gangs. So just go ahead and just be natural. Just act like your normal self. But just go ahead.
You gotta can it, because I already have written in my notes... Wow, Dorian, it's 2019. Pretty cool.
Yes.
Whoa! Sorry, I had to duck under that flying car.
I like that you scripted this.
I was able to text you via the mental telelink we set up.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite piece of new technology we invented?
I'll tell you what my least favorite is. It's these pesky replicants. I mean, how do you tell which one's a real human and which one's a replicant? And I can't for the life of me figure out if they dream of electric sheep or normal sheep. It's driving me bonkers.
What is consciousness?
Yeah. Enhance.
That fucking scene is my least favorite scene in terrible scenes in good movies.
Yep.
That's like the apex. Like, worst possible scene, best possible movie. Just him going, enhance.
Oh, God.
Enhance. For like a minute.
I love it. My favorite thing is, incidentally, it's always Ridley Scott movies, but just... old ass impressions of future technology that are just rickety and clanging.
Yeah.
Alien is filled with that too, where it's like mother and it's like
oh, it's so clanky.
It's so beautiful.
I
love it. I love this new utopia that we're living in here in the future.
It's the present.
Oop. This bit's falling apart for me.
We're collapsing.
How many more Blade Runner references can you fit in before we start the episode proper? Because I'm all out.
There was one in the new Spider-Man, which I liked. Spider-Verse?
Yeah. That movie was incredible, by the way, and you should totally see it if you haven't. I don't remember that part, though. What happened?
It was in the background of one of the future, the Penny Parkers, or whatever her name is.
Yeah.
The girl with the robot.
Mm-hmm.
It was when she's getting sucked into the wormhole. There was like a, I think there was like a billboard. I read about it after, but, you know, it's cool.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
I liked all the little billboards that they had in the background.
Yeah,
like,
it was neat.
Seth Rogen stars in Hold Your Horses. It's just him as a horse jockey.
That big Chance the Rapper one, but it's, there
four.
Was a different hat.
Yeah. He had a four hat.
Yeah.
So good. Well, we're not here to talk about great movies.
Nope.
But we were sponsored by Into the Spider-Verse, Spider-Man, now available in theaters. They gave us millions of dollars. Did you know this?
I was going to say, I've given that money. Given that movie tens of dollars.
Tens of dollars? You saw it more than once? Or did you pay for another ticket, another person's ticket. Paid for another ticket. Oh, okay. That's very sweet of you.
Yeah, it was very nice.
It was a very good movie.
Thank you.
Anyway, we're here to talk about death and decomposition. Max, you've prepared a topic for us to discuss today.
I have. But real quick, I did also want to extend the intro for even longer by saying, so I'm dog sitting right now.
Yeah.
They didn't give me their Wi-Fi password.
That's which is unacceptable.
Yeah, and I've been there for a week. It's 2019. You can't do that.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of this episode in, and mostly I'm saying this because I know we have listeners all over the United States, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know if other places have these. I did this episode in a grocery store, but not just any grocery store. It's a 24-hour grocery store that you used to be employed at.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That has like multiple full kitchens and a cafe and a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's open 24 hours. So I just got a beer and drank and wrote in the upstairs of this cafe.
Yeah.
In this grocery store. And I don't know if other places have these, but I was thinking about it, and it just sounds like the most heinous concept ever.
You think so?
If you're uninitiated, yeah, I think it sounds crazy if you've never encountered one of these.
It's definitely great in theory if it operates well. It's like, oh, yeah, 24/7. I don't mind that.
Yeah.
But it can be a hellscape to work there. I've heard from other people.
So if you're anywhere else and you have those, let us know. Tweet at me. I want to figure out if other places have that.
24/7 grocers.
That's not in Ohio or Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And specifically with like bars and kitchens. I don't know. I don't care. So I thought, Dorian, that before we really snap into today's topic, I thought it would be cool to reminisce over a couple of the best death-based stories from 2018 for a few minutes as well.
Ooh, absolutely.
I don't want to take up a ton of our runtime, but I thought it would be fun to have a little free-form chat about some of this stuff.
Mm.
Do you want to drink seltzer now?
I absolutely always want to drink seltzer.
Okay,
forever.
Cool. Hell yeah.
So let's crack into it.
Let's crack into the pre-topic with the pre-Dead Boys crack into the pre-topic moment.
Jointly sponsored by Polar and Waterloo Seltzers.
Both excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
Cool. Hey, Max, guess what?
What?
Waterloo! You love that shit.
I do fucking love ABBA, man. So I ran a list of a few cool death archaeology things that came out of this year, 2018. I mean, last year, 2018.
Last year. That was the past.
That was the past. And figured we'd just do a quick rundown. So, first up, did you hear about the Baraka skeleton that got found?
Baraka skeleton?
Yeah.
No, I don't know what that is.
You remember Baraka from Mortal Kombat?
Like the guy with the sword arms?
Yeah. So this was a skeleton dubbed TUS-380 that was found in northern Italy in 1996. However, this year, they re-examined the skeleton and found that this dude's arm, like his arm had been cut off, but then it was replaced with a big knife.
That is so fucking cool.
Which is sick, yeah. Here's a photo from the paper. The paper is titled Survival to Amputation in Pre-Antibiotic Era, a case study from a Longobard necropolis, 6th to 8th centuries AD, by Iliana Micarelli.
Wow. So the forearm was kind of, like, half of it was intact.
Uh-huh.
But the knife went up the rest of the way.
Yeah, so it wasn't at the elbow. It's like at the about halfway down the forearm.
Okay. And what culture is this? Where is this from?
Italians.
Do you think this this person was used in gladiatorial combat?
Probably not. And the reason being, this person actually lived for quite a while after getting his arm severed. You can read about this in this excerpt that I pulled from the paper here.
The necropolis of Povegiano Veronese is divided... Wait, can I roll that back and roll my R's there?
Yeah, get your R. I can't roll my R's.
The necropolis of Povegiano... Shit! The necropolis of Povegiano Veronese is divided into several sections. The largest section of the necropolis with burials is found in the northern part of the necropolis. This is where TUS-380 was found. TUS-380 is a single pit burial located in the northern region of the site. This section of the necropolis also features the deposition of a headless horse and two dogs. Good boys. The TUS 380 burial pit was originally dug in clay-based soil without a coffin. The body was placed in the pit with the head pointing west-southwest. The grave goods found in this tomb consist of a bronze D-shaped buckle and an iron knife. The latter was found in association with non-human organic material. All of this material was found close to the end of right forearm. This Longobard male shows a remarkable survival after a forelimb amputation during pre-antibiotic era. Not only did he adjust very well to his condition, he did so with the use of a culturally derived device along with considerable community support. Most likely, he had a prosthesis that was used to protect the stump. The archaeological evidence for this seems clear. The difference between TUS 380 and all of the other male burials is emphasized by the arm position, the placement of the D-shaped buckle, and the presence of bindings. This distinction is also indicated by the biological evidence. The tooth wear, bone loss of the right humerus, and slight change in right shoulder orientation suggest that a prosthesis was often fitted to the stump, and that this repetitive activity had a profound effect on his skeletal morphology.
Yeah, so basically this dude lost his right hand and then had a knife reattached to cover up the end.
That's so rad.
Yeah, it's like Baraka, man.
Yeah.
And they were
you,
like...
You say that, but Baraka has giant full-length swords coming both wrists, and he's chopping people up like scissors. This is considerably smaller, but it's still very cool.
Yeah, and it's cool that they found that out because they were like... He would have had to tie the knife on with his teeth.
Right.
And so they were like, oh, his molars are kind of worn down. That must be from like biting on the leather, chewing it. Kind of neat.
Yeah.
So for this next one, do you remember all the weird stuff that came out of Pompeii this year? I feel like this year was a big year for Pompeii.
Refresh my memory.
So first there was that really good picture of the skeleton where it looked like the giant boulder had just landed directly on his head.
Yeah, that was amazing.
That was really good. But there's an even worse fate out of Pompeii. And buddy, it's going to blow your mind. You know how when you leave a bunch of cans of LaCroix in your car during the winter and then they get really cold and they freeze and they explode?
Yes.
And then the trunk of your car is full of LaCroix?
Yes, I do. Sadly.
So it turns out the same thing can happen to the human skull when it gets really, really hot.
Oh.
Yeah. If you're really squeamish, you might want to skip over this next bit. But here's an excerpt from a paper titled A Hypothesis of Sudden Body Fluid Vaporization in the 79 AD Victims of Vesuvius by Pierpaolo Petrone. A lot of Italy stuff here.
Is that a death metal song? That title.
Sudden body fluid vaporization.
Careful inspection of the victim's skeletons revealed cracking and explosion of the skull cap and blackening of the outer and inner layers of the cranial bone associated with black exudations. In other words, when liquid pours out from the skull openings and the fractured bone. Such effects appear to be the combined result of direct exposure to heat and an increase in intracranial steam pressure induced by brain boiling, with skull explosion as the possible outcome.
Yeah, this is brutal.
Woo! Most metal thing that we've covered so far in this very metal show. We talk a lot about a lot of gruesome things.
Yeah.
And we haven't talked about exploding heads yet.
Yeah, like this is gnarly.
But... It's sick, literally. It's disgusting.
Yeah, so... Basically, people would be exposed to extremely hot air temperatures, and it's just everywhere. It's like you're being cooked in an oven. And because of that, the fluid and blood in their brain literally boils and vaporizes, and when water heats up, it expands, and that causes the pressure inside the skull to crack and split and actually burst open.
That's wild. Yeah. I do want to take a pause here and retroactively reprimand you for that. You said that this is mind-blowing. I caught that pun. You thought you would sneak it in, but I know what you did.
Yeah, I felt good about that
and
one.
You're a real bastard, and you have to do a timeout after this episode.
It's way less funny than that guy with the big boulder on his head. That poor guy. He's getting wrecked.
Yep.
So here's the last cool death discovery before we actually get into the episode. And I forgot that this had happened in 2018. I thought it was like 2 years ago. You remember when people got really riled up because we thought we had found Alexander the Great's tomb?
Right, yeah.
That's that big, dumb, old sarcophagus.
Yeah.
So if you didn't see this, which I don't know how people would have missed it, because I feel like it was all over Twitter for like 4 days.
Yeah. Nobody drank that out of the sarcophagus, did they?
That was so fucking funny. But it was a 2,000-year-old sarcophagus, and it weighed 30 tons. It was made out of black granite, and it looked like the coolest thing in the world.
For sure.
And everyone, like, lost their minds because all the nerds were like, oh, we found Alexander the Great's tomb. Like, whoa, cool.
Yeah.
Which, if you recall, in our mummy episode, we never found his body. But it was probably also encased in honey, which means that if we find it, it's still good.
Mmm.
Nice.
And delicious.
But then all the other people who were funny on Twitter and us were like, oh, man, it's going to inflict this horrible curse if we open it.
Yes.
It's going to be wild.
Open the sarcophagus.
And it turns out when we did open it, it was just full of, like, sewage.
Just juice.
Yeah. It was, like, all red.
Rotten human juice. I think that coincided, too. It was like, let us eat Tide Pods and let us drink from the sarcophagus. We want to put so bad stuff in us.
I think I was looking back at old headlines. And I think my favorite one was just, big mysterious coffin opened, comma, sucks. Because it was just like three random dudes who were in there. It wasn't notable people or anything.
Yeah, it's a bit of a letdown.
Yeah, but still super funny.
Yeah.
So anyway, now that we've talked for like 20 minutes about nothing even relating to the episode topic.
Well, it's related to death.
Yeah.
We had a good year in weird death stuff.
Yeah, a lot of weird death stuff.
It's been a great year.
So my girlfriend and I are planning to head out to the American Southeast this summer with a couple friends. Like, we're going to try and do, like, Nevada, Utah, all that good stuff. It's going to be really fun.
Hmm.
But naturally, since I'm a bummer, I've been reading about the story of these four German tourists who got lost in the Nevada desert and died of heat exposure and dehydration. And we only found two of the bodies, and it's real sad. Real peppy stuff. This episode isn't about them. And instead of somewhere low and hot, we're going high and cold. We're going to be talking about Mount Everest and all the dead bodies up there and what we do with them.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So for those who might be unaware of, like, mountains and literally one of the five most famous places in the world.
If you've probably heard of, if you've heard of mountains, you've heard of this one mountain.
Oh, you're a fan of Landforms? Name five of their songs. So here's what Mount Everest is for the uninformed and why we're talking about it today.
Mount Everest is Earth's highest mountain above sea level, located in the Mahalangar Himal subrange of the Himalayas. Everest reaches a total height of 29,029 feet, approximately 8,848 meters. Mount Everest attracts many climbers, some of them highly experienced mountaineers. There are two main climbing routes, one approaching the summit from the southeast in Nepal, known as the Standard Route, and the other from the north in Tibet. While not posing substantial technical climbing challenges on the Standard Route, Everest presents dangers such as altitude sickness, weather, and wind, as well as significant hazards from avalanches and the Khambu icefall. As of 2018, 297 people are known to have died on Everest, many of whose bodies remain on the mountain.
Yeah, Everest has drawn a lot of blood.
For sure.
Mountain climbing's tough stuff. Like, it's understandable. You can see why this happens.
Yeah.
But before we get into all the dead bodies, I figured we'd have some more history. So Mount Everest was the holy grail of mountain climbing for a long time. Because if you think about it, mountaineering clubs were primarily focused in the Alps. That's a mountain range that crosses from France, Switzerland, Italy, a bunch of European countries. However, because the cost of travel was so prohibitive, and there were a lot of cultural barriers between Europeans and the people around Everest that they were trying to colonize and kill and exploit, all that stuff, the mountain was relatively low profile back in Europe. However, as the British continued to colonize India, interest in Everest grew steadily. In 1885, a mountaineer by the name of Clinton Dent published a book titled Above the Snow Line, Mountaineering Sketches Between 1870 and 1880. In it, he theorized about the possibility of climbing Everest, but he also acknowledged the present danger.
Of course, I am only discussing the actual possibility, not entering into the question for a moment of whether it is worthwhile to do it. It may be that to attempt an ascent of Mount Everest would prove almost as rash an undertaking as an endeavor to swim through the Niagara Rapids. That is, if the mountaineering difficulties are so great as to make the two instances parallel. Two points have to be considered. One, that granted the desirability of making such an ascent, we do not yet fully know the best manner of undertaking it. And another, that we are still very ignorant as to the physiological effects of rarefied air on the human frame.
So here, Dent is fully aware that this is going to be a tough undertaking. I don't know if you know this. It's one of those things I'm mentally assent to, but I don't really know it. Climbing a mountain isn't just as simple as going up in a straight line, because mountains aren't the same all the way around.
Sure.
Did you see Free Solo?
No.
So that was that movie about the guy who climbed up El Capitan in Yosemite without any sort of ropes or anything.
Okay.
It's horrifying. It's terrifying. But he actually goes up for a little while and then has to scoot over and go down and make like a U to get back up to the top because you can't just go straight up.
Okay. Now, Free Solo, is that like a movie adaptation of Free Ski on Windows PCs?
What is Free Ski?
You never played Free Ski?
No, I was more of a Space Cadet pinball guy.
Ooh, okay. I think it was that same era.
Okay.
It was one of those free games on Windows computers from way back in the day. But you just ski down a mountain and it's super simple, little 2D game. But if you ski way too far off the path, a little abominable snowman starts chasing you and it eats you.
Oh.
It's pretty cool. Fond memories. That snowman freaked me out as a kid.
I was scared of the snowman in the Rudolph special. I didn't like him.
Oh, yeah, the Bumble.
I didn't like him. It's
but,
freaky.
But Max, Bumbles, they bounce. Remember that shit.
Just put that under my hat.
That's true shit. Bumbles bounce.
So there's...
I fucked you up on that one, huh?
Just like in Rudolph's journey to the North Pole to save Christmas or whatever happens in that movie.
Right.
To get up a mountain... you have to take diversions, and you have to take different paths. You
yes.
can't just go in a straight line.
Right.
Each path presents unique risks, dangers, and advantages. One of the biggest disadvantages and risks that Dent mentions here is rarefied air. Do you know Everest actually reaches into the stratosphere?
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's all. Holy shit.
So rarefied air, obviously, at that height, Earth's atmosphere gets way more thin. In addition to that, because winds can reach up to 175 miles an hour, it's extremely dry. So these conditions are hell on the human body. It's terrible. Mm. But they present a great opportunity for desiccation.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, we're talking earlier, like, it's tough because the air is really thin. But you know how athletes have to go play in Denver? They play like a Colorado team and they're like, they have to get oxygen therapy because it's so high. The altitude is so high.
Yeah. I just know from USC, one of the best heavyweight fighters in the world is Cain Velasquez.
Mm-hmm.
But people talk about him as nobody can beat him when he's at sea level. Because anytime he's fought at elevation, he loses.
And he's just not used to it?
Yeah. Which there's sound logic to that. But it's also kind of funny to mythologize this man as like, nobody can beat sea level Cain.
Yeah.
Altitude Cain, that's a surmountable task, but sea level Cain, can't
no
be
way.
Done.
So
yeah, altitude, it's
yeah.
it fucks with you. It's
yeah.
thin air.
And like, you know, athletes go play in Denver and they have to have oxygen masks and get there a day early to acclimate.
Mm-hmm.
Denver is 5,000 feet. Everest is 29,000 feet tall. So literally over five times the elevation.
That's wild.
Yeah, so that sets up a perfect opportunity for desiccation and suffocation. So back to history real quick here. The first serious attempts to climb Everest were made in 1921 and 1922 by the British. Both of these expeditions were helmed by George Mallory, who was an English mountaineer who actually ended up dying when he was trying to climb Everest in 1924. So after Mallory's death, most attempts to climb the mountain were exploratory. You gotta go feel it out.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta figure out where you can step, what's gonna collapse.
Poke in the soft spots, see if they'll give a little bit.
Yeah. That is until Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary became the first official pair to summit the mountain in 1953. By this point, 1953, 13 people had already died trying to climb the mountain. So because it's so intimidating to climb, deaths didn't really happen frequently at the start. A lot of people were trying to figure out routes, and disasters still happened, but Everest was pretty inaccessible. The turning point in Everest's death legacy happened in 1987. By 1987, only about 200 people ever had climbed Everest, and about 83 people had died. In the 30 years since then, however, commercial interest in climbing has exploded. Now there's companies you can take. There's a whole route that's like roped off up the mountain. According to the Himalayan database, Everest has been summited 8,306 times, which is wild.
Yeah, that's you know? A lot.
Like, you think this is like the biggest physical challenge in the world, but also it's been done 8,000 times. I don't know. That's not really that many.
Right.
But
still, the success rate has gotten significantly better.
Yeah. But 297 people have also died on the mountain, which is also a lot.
Yeah.
A majority of these folks die of avalanches or just of exhaustion and exposure. All this climbing has another downside as well, which is trash.
A Tech Times story describes the mountain as the world's highest garbage dump. People have left oxygen canisters, broken climbing equipment, trash, and human waste in their wake. A 2013 National Geographic article on Everest states, quote, "The two standard routes, the Northeast Ridge and the Southeast Ridge, are not only dangerously crowded, but also disgustingly polluted, with garbage leaking out of the glaciers and pyramids of human excrement befouling the high camps," end quote. The Everest Summiteers Association, which has also collected tons of debris from the mountain, estimates there might be as much as 10 tons of trash left on Everest, a figure that is only expected to grow.
Yeah.
Pyramids of poop!
Yeah, it's gross. The photos of this are remarkable.
Oh, no.
Because you would think it's so inhospitable that people don't want to, like, hang out there.
Right.
But they're just camps and just filth everywhere. You can see, like, lines of people making their way up Everest. It's really interesting.
Huh.
Yeah. So part of the difficulty in removing trash from Everest...
And poop pyramids.
And poop. Is the same reason so many dead bodies are simply abandoned on Everest. It's already hard enough to traverse the mountain, and it's even more difficult to traverse it with a bag of trash or a body. According to the Smithsonian Institution, more than 200 bodies are still left on the mountain, either buried under avalanches, trapped in crevices, or stuck at the foot of ice sheets. The sheer amount of effort required to remove a body can be staggering.
Ang Shuring, president of the Nepal Mountaineering Association, told the BBC, quote, "Even picking up a candy wrapper high up on the mountain is a lot of effort, because it's totally frozen and you have to dig around it. A dead body that normally weighs 180 pounds might weigh over 300 pounds when frozen and dug out with the surrounding ice attached."
Yeah, it's like really bad freezer burn.
Yeah, why bother at that point?
Yeah. And you gotta think about this, too. You can't just, like, throw the body down the mountain. That's a little disrespectful.
Yeah.
Also dangerous.
Yeah.
You have to lower it down on a sled, and that sled is also being pulled down the mountain by gravity. So imagine you're trying to, like, traverse down this slippery, icy mountain, and also you're kind of dragging this 300-pound thing that is also being pulled down the mountain. It's tough.
Right.
I don't think it's great that there are a lot of just corpses being left on this mountain, but you can see why it's almost a necessity.
Yeah. So, I do really like the thought of, like, all right, we've lost, you know, Steve. This is very sad. We need to be respectful and bring his corpse back to society. And they just, like, chuck this 300-pound chunk of ice down like a mountain and let him just fall where he may.
Like, we'll get him later.
We did our duty.
It's like Encino Man.
Yeah.
So, Dorian, This brings us to the most famous body left on Everest, Green Boots.
Green Boots is the name given to the unidentified corpse of a climber that became a landmark on the main northeast ridge route of Mount Everest. Though his identity has not been officially confirmed, he is believed to be Su Wong Paljor, an Indian climber who died on Mount Everest in 1996. All expeditions that depart from the north side encounter the body curled in the limestone alcove cave at 27,900 feet.
Yeah, so it's kind of a sad thing to think about.
Yeah.
I can't really imagine what it would be like to be a climber and be doing a thing that you could very legitimately die doing and regularly have to, like, see dead bodies and step over corpses on the way up, you know? Maybe it's like a terror management thing.
Maybe.
You feel spurred to, like, make a name for yourself or accomplish something.
Yeah, I imagine that's part of the challenge, is it's not just a physical feat. That's got to mess with you psychologically.
Yeah.
That takes a degree of fortitude that, you know, I'd like to think that I have. I'd like to think that I watched enough Friday the 13th movies that, oh, a dead body wouldn't bother me. I've seen that sort of thing. But that'd be horrifying.
Yeah. To know that they did the same thing you were doing.
Yep.
And could have even been more fit or athletic or well-equipped, you know?
Yeah.
It's freaky.
Mm-hmm.
So the really sad thing, too, is that people are left on Everest regularly. It's not just like someone gets stuck or that we've kind of curbed this from happening. It's still pretty regular. Another famous body is the body of Hannelore Schmatz, who was the first woman to die up on the mountain. Now, she actually did reach the top and was on her way back down, but she was exhausted. So she set up camp where the oxygen was too thin, and she actually suffocated overnight. So for a long time, her body was also just like Green Boots, and you can find photos of this online, just sitting in plain sight and remarkably well preserved because, again, it's really cold up there.
Bodies remain in a surprisingly intact state despite the harsh climate of Everest. Most of this preservation stems from a combination of a lack of oxygen and extreme cold. Any moisture remaining in a dead body is sucked out by harsh winds, leaving only desiccated remains behind. Once dehydrated, the only thing that would disturb the body is avalanches and landslides, as there is no other life on the mountain.
Yeah, it's eerie looking at these photos that are almost like monuments in a way. They're almost statuesque.
Hmm.
But luckily, not everyone chooses to ruthlessly leave bodies on the mountain. Some Sherpas, who are the people who live in the surrounding area and help people get up the mountain, some Sherpas regularly make ascents to cover or provide ritual funerals to those that have died on the mountain.
Hmm. In order to ensure safe routes for the living, remains are usually committed to the mountain. That is, they are respectfully pushed into a crevasse or off a steep slope, out of sight. When possible, they might also be covered with rocks, forming a burial mound. Even for a fresh body, however, those respectful acts can take hours and require the effort of several fit climbers. The question remains of whose responsibility that task should fall to, especially as more bodies have built up over the years.
Should give you an indication of like how bananas the environment around this area is, that just pushing someone into a big ditch is respectful.
Yeah.
But you literally can't do anything else. It's stuck otherwise.
Right.
You know? And there's a certain group of people out there who deserve, I think, a round of applause from us as well. They're the folks at the Asian Trekking Corporation. So they have come out and said that they think it's kind of messed up that people are just leaving trash and dead bodies up on Everest. Mm-hmm. Understandable.
Yep.
And have a lot of respect for the bodies that are up there as well. So they also think it's really ignoble for people to just be taking photos of all these corpses that they see on their way up. So they actually lead trips every year where they're not trying to climb Everest, but they go up and collect trash and remove bodies from the mountain. Yeah, so far they've collected over 33,000 pounds of trash and have conducted about 5 funerals, which is pretty impressive when you consider the effort that goes into even conducting one of them.
Right.
So, you know, let's give them a little Pre-Dead Boys round of applause.
Woo! Yeah! You did it!
I'm sure we're gonna, how many times we're gonna peek the mic there.
That's a really pitiful gesture. It's the best we can really muster right now. But yeah, I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
They're willing to do this.
Yeah, it's remarkable. So I have two more stories before we head on out. One's pretty rough, but the other illustrates some folks coming together because of a shared reverence for death. So I get it if, like, you leave a dead body up there because it's really difficult to get down and it weighs like 300 pounds and it's dangerous. But unfortunately, there have been a lot of cases recently of people succumbing to something called summit fever.
David Sharp, an English mountaineer, was attempting to summit Everest on his own, a feat even the most advanced climbers would warn against. He had stopped to rest near the body of Green Boots, as so many had done before him. Over the course of several hours, he froze to death, his body stuck in a huddled position, just feet from one of the most famous Mount Everest bodies. Unlike Green Boots, however, who had likely gone unnoticed during his death due to the small amount of people hiking at that time, at least 40 people passed by Sharp that day. Not one of them stopped. Sir Edmund Hillary, the first man to ever summit the mountain, criticized the climbers who had passed by Sharp and attributed it to the mind-numbing desire to reach the top. He told the New Zealand Herald after news of Sharp's death broke, quote, "If you have someone who is in great need, and you are still strong and energetic, then you have a duty, really, to give all you can to get the man down, and getting to the summit becomes very secondary. I think the whole attitude toward climbing Mount Everest has become rather horrifying. The people just want to get to the top. They don't give a damn for anybody else, who may be in distress, and it doesn't impress me at all that they leave someone lying under a rock to die."
Yeah, so I'm firmly in Hillary's camp here, with this being pretty sick.
Yeah.
The David Sharp incident made headlines when it happened, and a lot of people were immediately criticizing the companies that put this on for, you know, basically endangering lives. But you got to realize that people just left this dude there.
Right.
And he was alive, very clearly alive. Unfortunately, sometimes because of the conditions, leaving someone where they are and basically leaving them for dead is a sad inevitability. Unfortunately, that's what happened with Frances DiStefano Arsentiev. Now, she was a world-class climber who tried to climb Everest without oxygen and, unfortunately, died in the process. She was climbing with her husband, Sergey, and after they reached the top, they were separated on the way back down. They waded through most of the night, and then as the sun was coming up the next morning, they tried to make contact, but Sergey unfortunately fell and died trying to rescue her. Frances was injured, and she was stuck. Two people, Ian Woodall and Kathy O'Dowd, were actually ascending to the top of the mountain and came across her body, though. So they stuck with her for like an hour, and then unfortunately they had to keep going down the mountain because conditions were getting too bad for them to stick with her any longer, and she just couldn't move. So unfortunately, Frances would later die on the mountain. And while this sounds like a bummer, what happened after is actually kind of respectable.
Woodall, who had stayed with Frances in her dying hours, had become haunted by his inability to save her, and deeply bothered by the fact that her body had become a landmark. In 2007, Woodall, with Kathy O'Dowd's support, returned to Everest specifically to remove Frances's body from sight. The original plan was to create a rock cairn for Frances, but to Woodall's dismay, when he reached the spot where she died, he found the area buried in 4 feet of snow. He began to dig. Woodall and Furry Sherpa, his partner, eventually found Frances. A rock grave was no longer an option, but they had just enough rope to lower her body over the mountain's edge. After wrapping her stiff remains in an American flag and saying a few words, they sent her on her way, likely to the same place where her husband Sergey lies. All told, it took them 5 hours. Woodall was able to find and contact Frances's son, Paul, after conducting the mission, and the two were able to form a strong bond over Woodall's act. Paul recounted, quote, My mother and I are bonded by blood, and Ian, Kathy, and her are bonded by death. I feel that they had just as much a right to move her as we did, and my family honors their effort.
Yeah, so I think that's a really cool example of what it's like to not be like an absolute darsh to other people.
Yeah.
And just leave them. I think it's also kind of a cool example of something I feel like we've hit on multiple times, which is the need that people have to grieve in a community. You know?
Yeah.
Like, we've talked about how you can't just suffer in silence. I think we've seen with like the reef balls and like space launches, there's kind of a cool thing that happens when people are able to come together to grieve and have a shared experience. And that seems to be what happened here. I think it's kind of a cool story about, you know, this tragic thing ultimately turning into a way for these two people to meet and kind of form a connection and respect someone else's death, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And just beyond the heroic deed of, you know what, fuck the whole ascent to the top. Like, that does not matter. What matters now is paying respects to this person who lost her life.
Yeah.
And these people who lost their life, this couple. Even aside from that, it's kind of amazing that something tragic can bring people together like that.
Yeah. In such, like, stark contrast to the people who just kind of step over bodies or use them as waypoints.
Right.
You know?
Well, it's a somber one, but thank you so much. This story is a good note to end on. It's a little bit uplifting that not everyone is a total piece of shit just trying to scramble their way to the top.
Yeah, and like if y'all are like me and you're still like, wow, it must be really hard to climb Everest. It is really hard. I'm not discounting what people who have done it do, but check out photos of like commercial expeditions going to the top of Everest. It's just big chains of people. It looks like, I don't know, it's kind of like, it's almost surreal seeing this big just row of jackets marching up the mountain. It's kind of wild.
It's kind of getting less impressive maybe over time.
Yeah.
Just the more we're kind of, it's getting a little commonplace. But being decent to other human beings and respectful of the grieving and the dead is, you know, that's always something that's going to be a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you for this. It's a somber one, but it's a good one. We can't be total jackasses all the time, just goofing on dead people.
We did goof real hard on that big sarcophagus in the beginning.
That's true. Awesome. Well, thanks for listening to this episode. We love hearing from y'all. Tell us what you thought. Tell us your favorite crazy death stories of 2018. And don't tell us about your Everest trip if you stepped over dead bodies to get there. We'll razz you. We'll find you. We'll come to your house and give you a noogie.
I'll slash your tires.
That's right. You can follow us at PreDeadBoys on Twitter and Instagram. You can email us, predeadboys@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, that'd be tight. We'd appreciate support.
Oh, greatly.
Number one, first and foremost, is absolutely just tell your friends, your family, anyone who is interested in learning more about death, decomposition, and all these cool stories that Max puts so much work into researching. Just tell people who want to listen to this. That's the best way to support it. If you want to support us financially, you can go to ko-fi.com/predeadboys. Tip us $3 or more. Max, our number one fan, Drew, a.k.a. Anaconda Vice.
What's up, Drew?
He's working overtime, man.
I appreciate this dude so much.
Drew, I can't... I think it's getting to a point where I can't word-for-word read every sweet comment and review and donation that you've sent our way. But all of it is so appreciated. It's so awesome. Couple things. One, Drew asked if we're ever going to have like callers in on the show. The situation is we're recording this on one microphone in a bedroom. And I don't know the technology with that at all. But if you want to chat it up with us pretty much anytime on social media or email or whatever works best for y'all, we're always down to talk and just talk about stuff on the podcast, interesting books you're reading. I'm always down to talk about video games. And on that note,
tunes.
Max just dropped his favorite music of 2018 Spotify playlist.
Good one.
So keep an eye out for that. That was my favorite burp of 2018 right there. Drew, just quick video game aside. I'm going to connect with you at some point and, you know, we'll figure out how to make Smash happen. Challenge accepted.
Hell yeah.
Also, I'm so stoked for Resident Evil 2. Have you seen they're remaking Resident Evil 2?
No.
It's gorgeous. It looks so good and so scary. And they're just kind of remaking the entire game.
That's very cool.
Top to bottom. It looks so good. Unfortunately, I don't have a PS4 or an Xbox. I just have Switch. And I have too many Switch games right now that I don't have time to play. So I'm probably not going to play it, but I'm going to watch the shit out of, like, people who stream it and stuff, because it looks so cool. And that spooky zombie shit is right up my alley. Very stoked for it. Anyway, Drew, thank you so much for just, you've effectively chipped away at like a couple months worth of hosting fees, and we really, really appreciate that. Another way you can support the podcast is leaving us a 5-star review. Drew dropped the first ever review on Stitcher for our podcast.
I don't even know how to get on Stitcher.
Stitcher.com.
Okay. Just type it into my internet, like not a dummy.
Yeah, I mean, some people really like that service and use it. I use Podcast Addict, but, you know, it seems like a good platform for the people who are into it.
Sure.
But yeah, thank you. Again, I'm not going to read everything word for word, but all of it is really appreciated, Drew. We also got a review on iTunes. This one is from Fab Fab Weirdo. And Fab Fab Weirdo says, Max and Dorian, hand making the devil horns 3 times, and then 5 stars.
Oh, nice.
They say, I was told about this podcast by a mutual friend, and it does not disappoint. There's nothing like a great lighthearted approach to death. Way to do Columbus proud, guys. Let the carbonated H2O run. You're damn right, it's running.
Ah.
Also,
it ran.
614, go Bucks, all that good stuff. Thank you so much, Fab Fab Weirdo. We really appreciate it. Our intro and outro music is the song About Time by the band Brat Curse. Check them out at bratcurse.bandcamp.com. And thank you so much for listening. Please be safe out there. Watch out for all those flying cars and those pesky teenagers on their speedy
their
motorcycles.
Damn hoverboards. Slippery. We don't want anyone falling on any ice.
That's true. Especially the water main that broke just outside of your house and is just gushing water into the street.
Yeah, that thing's 24/7. Fucking ridiculous.
How long has it been since that's been going on?
It did it for 3 weeks, like a month ago, and then it was gone, and now it's back. So just shooting gallons of water in the street.
You know what? It's 2019.
Per minute.
Yeah, it's 2019 now. We're over it. We don't want to drink out of the sarcophagus anymore. We do want to drink out of that broken water main.
Yeah, I want the street water.
I want it. I want to drink it. Put it in my mouth.
Let's go take a street water hit.
Let's do it. Max and Dorian here reminding you, you're gonna rock.
See ya.
Bye.
He also acknowledged the present danger. Clear and present danger.
Starring Harrison Ford.
A lot of Harrison Ford talk.
What?
A lot of Harrison Ford talk this episode.
He's great. He's a legend.
Killed one of those damn robots for me. Oh, he just killed a robot out there right now. Look at that.
Wow.
He's killed a robot.
There's Deckard.
I can't wait for 30 more years in the future.
2049.